Echo, and anyone can quit. Resources at AmericanLegacy.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Studs Terkel just came out with his 12th book of oral history, Hope Dies Last, Keeping the Faith in Troubled Times. He brings together diverse voices, from a pardoned death row prisoner to an Iraqi immigrant, to talk about how hope has led them through hardship. Tonight on Point, 91-year-old chronicler Studs Terkel on his life and hope in America today. We begin in Washington, where today the Supreme Court agreed to hear a case brought on behalf of prisoners detained in Guantanamo Bay. The prisoners, alleged terrorists, are suing for the right to bring their cases in front of U.S. courts. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com. I asked her what fundamental issue the Supreme Court will consider in this case.
Well, actually, there's really only one issue for the court to decide, and paradoxically, that issue is there something for the court to decide? That there is no issue here about whether these detainees are innocent or guilty or whether they have clean conditions or whether they, you know, feel bad. The only issue for the court is whether American federal courts have jurisdiction even to hear these appeals. And so there's a strange way in which the courts have a very stark choice. They have to either write themselves absolutely out of this equation or throw themselves right into the middle.
The government has said the courts have no role here. If the Supreme Court decides differently, does that mean that each of the 600 and some detainees in Guantanamo would instantly have access to judicial process in American courts?
Well, there's all sorts of different ways the courts could decide. I mean, I could envision a universe in which they split hairs and start saying, you know, if they go ahead and do preliminary adjudications and determine that some people are enemy combatants and others are just merely foreign nationals, I can see them splitting hairs, divvying up the 660 detainees and then saying the court only has jurisdiction over some. But yes, in general, I think, as I said, it's such a stark decision. Essentially, the court is going to have to say, yes, you get habeas relief even if you're not an American on American soil, or no, none of you get habeas relief. So in the most profound way, I think, yes, the implications will in fact be for all the detainees.
Dahlia, what are the cases that the Supreme Court is picking up here?
Well, that's sort of one of the funny products of not going to war all that often, is that we're looking at World War II precedents, principally. The big, big case that has followed these appeals through the courts and to the District of Columbia's appellate court is a 1950 case called Eisenträger. That was a very strange set of facts in which there were 21 German spies who were in China after World War II, spying for the Japanese government against the United States. It's a little bit of a connect the dots. But essentially what happens is they were interned in Chinese jail, and they turned around and similarly said, we would like habeas corpus relief. We would like the American courts to adjudicate on the merits why we are here and whether you can hold us. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said unequivocally, no, you don't have the right to habeas relief. You're not Americans. You're not in the United States. You're in China. This is not our problem. And in fact, there's some lovely language from the opinion where the Supreme Court said, you know, if we are to allow anyone in the world to claim constitutional rights under the U.S. Constitution, we would be giving rights to werewolves, their language, not mine. And so the feeling was that after Eisenträger, if you are being held abroad and you are not an American, you simply don't have the right to relief under the U.S. Constitution.
So what are the cases whose appeal the court is hearing this time?
There are two consolidated cases that have come. Ironically, it's not even clear that the named plaintiffs in these cases know that they are the plaintiffs in these cases. The cases are coming from the families and lawyers of a bunch of Australian, British, and Kuwaiti citizens who are being held in Guantanamo. So essentially the court agreed to conflate these two cases, to consolidate and hear just this one case on the principle, do these people have to sit in Guantanamo without access to lawyers, without any finding of guilt, without even knowing the charges against them until, quote, the end of this war on terror?
And what did their attorneys argue before lower courts?
Well, what they've argued is that even under the broadest construction of the Geneva Convention, you just don't get to hold prisoners of war indefinitely without some kind of adjudicatory process. essentially what their attorneys are arguing is, one, Eisentrager does not apply here because in Eisentrager, those German spies had already gone through an initial finding of guilt. They had attorneys. They had some due process. That's not the case here. And more importantly, and I think compellingly, they argue this isn't China. This is Guantanamo. We may not think it's a part of the United States. It's not legally a part of the United States. We lease it. We don't own it. But what the attorneys are saying is, look, this is a piece of land that is in the United States control. It is not fair to say we don't have jurisdiction, because if the United States doesn't have jurisdiction, who does?
And what did the U.S. government argue in response?
Well, their response has been pretty similar to what it's been on all these war on terror claims, which is we need to have the broad swath of deference from the courts and everyone else to do what we need to do to fight terrors. Essentially, what they're saying is this is wartime. During wartime, the courts kind of need to butt out. The executive takes precedence. And so if we determine that this is a matter of national security, you simply have to defer to us. And even though that sounds like quite an authoritarian argument, that is an argument that has won an awful lot of court cases over the years.
This could mean a real change in the parameters of how the so-called war on terror is fought in the future. Could it not?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there is a sense that, you know, here we are 2 years later after September 11th, and the pot is beginning to boil over a little bit. I think there's been tremendous backlash against the Patriot Act. I think there's a feeling that the court needs to step in and right the balance. And so absolutely, one way or another, the court is either going to say the Bush administration has just gone too far. They cannot continue to claim secrecy and executive privilege and sort of run amok. And I think it's more likely the court can step in and say, look, this is wartime. And even though it may be appalling that the government has to do it, sometimes in order to win the war, we have to defer. And so either way, I think it's going to reshape the legal landscape. But I think that in some sense, these issues have been snowballing for some time. And there is a feeling that these issues were sort of ripe for some kind of legal review.
Dahlia, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com. She spoke with me earlier today from Washington. Hope has never trickled down, writes Studs Terkel. It has always sprung up. Up, he might have added, from the people as Walt Whitman understood them, or Mark Twain, or Studs Terkel. Since the 1930s, Studs Terkel has been honing his legendary skills as an interviewer and oral historian. Now, at 91, he's captured the intimate thoughts of Americans of many stripes, but particularly social activists, on hope. Studs Terkel was born in the Bronx in 1912. His family moved to Chicago when he was 8. He attended the University of Chicago and received a law degree from Chicago's law school. He hated law and began work as a radio soap opera actor in Chicago. In the 1940s, he became a disc jockey. In the 1950s, had his own television show, Studs Corner. He was blacklisted in the McCarthy years. He returned to radio in 1953, playing music and interviewing guests. He would do so for the next 45 years. Studs Terkel published his first book, Division Street America, in 1967, and went on to gather American voices on the Great Depression, the Good War, life, death, sex, and more. Tonight on Point, Studs Terkel on hope. Where does hope sit in your life today? Are you fueled by hope or estranged from hope? What do you hear in the stories, the hopes of Studs Terkel at 91? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Studs Terkel, author of Hope Dies Last, Keeping the Faith in Difficult Times. Good evening and welcome, Studs Terkel.
Well, thank you very much.
It's wonderful to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. And Tom, you mentioned Whitman. The man we're talking tonight is our Whitman. He contains multitudes. Hello, Studs.
Oh, who's this? Jack Beatty?
Yes, it is.
It sure as heck is. Hi.
Oh, I'm so delighted to hear your voice.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And that was so. I associate you with the best years of the Atlantic.
That's great. It's great to have you both. Studs Terkel, it was just a couple of years ago, 2001, you came out with Death, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? You were not a spring chicken when you wrote that book, and many people thought it might, in fact, be your swan song. Did you know when you came out with that you were planning to come out with yet another book?
No, it's just there, I suppose. people ask me, when am I going to retire? And I say, when you say that, smile. I'm not going to fade out. I'm going to check out while I'm at the typewriter. I'm learning, for example, I'm learning now the wonders of the electric typewriter, which shows you how primitive I am when it comes to technology.
You're behind the curve. Why hope? Why hope in this book?
Well, it's a matter of hope. It seems like I was crazy to attempt it, especially at this time, because it seems the most abstract of all the books. The others are more visceral in nature. Remember, each of the books deals with a certain moment in our history.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel we are suffering from a national Alzheimer's disease. There is no memory of yesterday. 20-second soundbite makes what happened 21 seconds ago old history. So I was thinking, for example, what was it like to live during the Great American Depression of the 30s, to be a kid seeing her father come home with a tool chest on his shoulder at 10 o'clock in the morning, the carpenter, and he's on relief, and then thank goodness he's saved by the federal government as that which we call the free market, didn't call it that, then fell on its face and pleaded for relief from the government. Please regulate us, and they did. And the irony is, and here's where the Alzheimer's disease comes in, the irony is the very daddies and granddaddies of those whose butts were saved by government regulation, the ones who most condemn big government, to use the phrase Molly Ivins uses, when it comes to health, education, and welfare. So what was it like? What's it like to be a kid during World War II, a mama's boy hitting the shores of Normandy, or a woman having a job for the first time in her life, ironically enough, because of the war, or working? What's a teacher's life like, or that of a spot welder or a checkout counter clerk? And then it's going in white and black and our obsession and age and death. Well, here comes this matter of hope. I remember this woman. Her name was Jessie de la Cruz, one of the first women whom Cesar Chavez engaged as an organizer for his farm workers union. And she said, we have a saying in Spanish, when times are bleak and bewildering, esperanza muera al último. Hope dies last. Now, she told me that about 25 years ago, and somehow it's stuck with me. And at this moment, more than ever, I think, it's not simply abstract, as it seemed to me, but more personal than ever. And it's a sort of a tribute to those who we call activists, those who have been participating in our democracy one way or another, following, you might say, the precept of Tom Paine, who suggested the very thing to take part in our society in some communal action, no matter what it may be.
You say Tom Paine assumed a society not simply of citizens, but of thinking citizens.
Oh, you hit it.
And an idea we like an awful lot around here. Jack Beattie, Studs Terkel is jumping in here on hope. And as he says, it's not just any hope, though it's a very diverse. He's got all kinds of people here. The pilot of the Enola Gay who dropped the atomic bomb and other surprising entrants in this book. But he's focused it on the hope of social activists, kind of Studs Terkel's bread and butter.
He has. And, you know, it reminds me of a story about Woodrow Wilson. After he had his stroke, Senator Lodge came in to see him. And Senator Lodge, of course, was his bete noire. And Lodge looked at him and he said, "We're praying for you, Mr. President." And Wilson said, "Which way, Senator?" And, you know, I think that's the question about hope, isn't it, Studs? I mean, which way?
Of course. There are... You hit it, you know. Of course, we're a crazy, to begin with, the human species is absurd and horrendous and wonderful at the same time. Remember, we're the same species that gave us Shakespeare and Mozart's Don Giovanni and gave us Auschwitz and Hiroshima. The same people have done it, part of our species. And you ask about hope, well, which way? Well, obviously, a while ago we mentioned the fact that Tom Paine spoke not of freedom-loving people, who saying that a commoner can tell a king to bugger off. But he said, thinking is the italicized word. You know that Common Sense sold 150,000 copies. So that means what? What was the population then, about 4 million?
Pretty darn small. It'd be millions today.
Well, that would be about three. It would be the biggest bestseller of the decade.
Studs Terkel, stand by. We've got to take a break. We're talking with Studs Terkel about hope in a hard world. You can join us. Where does hope sit in your life today? Are you fueled by hope? or estranged from it? Are you hopeful about the country, the world, the future? We're at 1-800. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by Studs Terkel. He's writing about hope in a hard world in his new book, Hope Dies Last, Keeping the Faith in Difficult Times. You can join the conversation with Studs Terkel. The Greeks thought hope was the cruelest emotion. Do you agree? Or is hope the essential elixir? And what do you hear in the voice, the hopes, the memory of Studs Terkel at 91? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to be hearing the voices of some of the many Americans that Studs Terkel has captured in his new book in the course of this evening. But Studs, I wanted to ask you first. You've lived through depression, war, race riots, all kinds of conflict in this country, and yet in the very title of your book, you're calling these times, the times we're living in now, difficult times. Difficult compared to those?
Well, just remember, they're all times. You left out McCarthyism as well.
That little matter and more.
We had the witch hunts then, and we know the conversation stopper was the word communism, just as terrorism. We always had a conversation stopper, and that would stop all conversation. Mm-hmm. And thus, we know how many of us feel about the Patriot Act of my fellow alumnus. I have a confession to make to you. That John Ashcroft, our Attorney General, and I attended the same Institute of Higher Learning together, the University of Chicago Law School.
Okay.
You know, I preceded him by about 30 years, mm-hmm. but I'm convinced he is older than I am.
Because no, that would make him pretty old, Studs.
If you don't mind this, I have a theory. John Ashcroft is 350 years old because you saw him in the previous incarnation. When you saw Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, or the movie, he was the Reverend Paris. Remember the evangelist who came to town? There was hysteria about mm-hmm. witchcraft, and old women were accused of being witches or terrorists, you'd call that. And so he said to those young girls, you name names in the name of our God, or else you are consorting with the devil. Well, in a way, that was the first draft of the U.S. Patriot Act. So he's 350 years old.
But Studs Terkel, those towers did come down on 9/11/2001. It didn't look good. John Ashcroft would say, I'm defending this nation.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, I didn't hear. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying that on September 11th, 2001, those towers did come down. A lot of people died. John Ashcroft would say, I'm doing what's required to defend this nation.
Right. You see, September 11th, of course, is a horrendous event and an assault that was obscene in nature. But there's another assault taking place, the assault upon our native intelligence, the one that Tom Paine wrote about, the one that Walt Whitman sang about, the one that abolitionists talked about. And it's the assault on our intelligence by this administration, as well as upon. I've always believed in all my books, one of the subtexts has always been people are basically intelligent, may not be knowledgeable because of the nature of who controls the media, how it filters through, but the intelligence and the sense of decency has always been there. And I believe it's never been under greater assault than it is now.
How did you choose the people that you spoke with for this book, Studs? How did you decide who to sit down with? There are many social activists here, many, but also a great diversity. I mean, you have Dennis Kucinich here, but also the Republican Dan Burden. You've got Tom Hayden, but you've also got the man who dropped the bomb on Hiroshima.
Paul Tibbetts,
quite a wide swath.
Well, see, especially Dan Burden is a conservative, and he's a fan of George Bush, but he's something else. He's a very bone-deep, honest man. I like him very much. He's very candid about his boyhood and childhood. His father was a bully who beat up his mother regularly, beat up the kids. And he said, from that moment on, I hated bullies. And he comes to J. Edgar Hoover. He said, there was a man who was a bully, too. And he wants the name of John Edgar Hoover removed from that building, bearing his name. He described a certain case, not involving politics, but, you know, the FBI used certain informants who were mafia thugs. Mm. And one of them framed a guy who spent 30 years in prison. And he's convinced J. Edgar Hoover knew all about it. And he called him a bully and a craven toady. And I respect Dan Burden for that. And, of course, if I saw him now, we continue our conversation and say, well, let's continue on the subject of bullies. Why is it that, I wouldn't do it now, I'd like to do it in his presence.
Yes.
Because he and I could have a little colloquy together. Why is it? By the way, he did say one thing. He says he did have some difficulty with a man he admires, George Bush. He wants more evidence. And one of Bush's subordinates said to him, no, it's national security. And he's mad about that. And he attributes it to Mr. Gonzalez. He means, of course, Alberto Gonzalez,
mm-hmm.
who has often been a...
White House counsel.
Who's been an occasional administration, a possible nominee to the Supreme Court. And see, what Dan Burton does, of course, is take away the responsibility from the guy ultimately responsible. But, of course, I like him. And though he be a to the right politically, because he's an honest man.
You've got the range there. At Harvard, you've got John Kenneth Galbraith. You've also got a building manager at Harvard University that we spoke to today. Let's just get a little flavor of some of the interviews that you've done for this book, Studs, if we may. We spoke earlier today with Bob Kelly. Bob is a building manager at Harvard University. He refers to himself as a glorified custodian. He's worked at Harvard for 14 years full-time, 3 years part-time. He talked about his view of the students there changed when they organized to improve the working conditions of Harvard's employees.
When I first came, I didn't like the students at all. I resented them a great deal, and I just looked at them as wealthy snobs. They don't see you. Some of them won't speak to you. If they see you in the street, they don't see you. I had resentments towards them, and it's taken a while over the years. When this living wage campaign started, it was really run out of this building. I'd notice those students working nights and days. They'd be here running off copies, having meetings all night. They'd be in here at 7:30 in the morning, going out postering. They were doing something that they would gain nothing from. You know what I mean? It's wonderful to see a generation of these people that went to bat like that with nothing to gain for themselves. What does it give you? Hope is what it gives you.
Bob Kelly, Studs Terkel, what did you hear in that
Bob,
voice?
Was that Bob talking now?
Yes, it was Bob himself.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for being yourself. Now, you see, what Bob has done, this is remarkable. This did not happen in the 60s, as Bob would be the first to tell you. In the 60s, you know, there were the students who fought against a maladventure in Southeast Asia, who along with African Americans fought for civil liberties. Now, many of the... blue-collar people, like Bob, you know, not him, were anti these students. But something has happened now. They're together, and they recognize in the students recognize in them, allies. And I think that's wonderful. You know, Bob used that phrase, sometimes people can surprise you. I love that phrase.
And in those surprises, you can find hope. He found hope.
The possibility in people there. Once they get the facts, and Bob, of course, learned from the very experience that these are good kids, you know, who were doing this at risk for the sake of Bob and his colleagues. And now he has another opinion of them. And they, of course, recognize in Bob a name and a face and a guy.
We're talking tonight with the legendary Studs Terkel. His new book is Hope Dies Last, Keeping the Faith in Difficult Times. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Carol's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I would like to say that I cannot thank Mr. Terkel enough for his insights. My problem is I'm an old 60s person who had very high standards, and I'm going to commit a grammatical error and say now that I and all my 60s friends are absolutely shell-shocked at the Philistine environment that seems to be pervading this country. And when someone is ethical, intelligent, and responsible, we're called the intellectual elite. You know, I am a very down-to-earth person. I can be, I don't know if I'd say this on the air, a shit kicker or whatever, but I do not appreciate the attitude that is prevailing now.
The idea that a thinking citizen is somehow an elitist. Studs Terkel, how about it?
You know, I'm sorry. You know, my hearing is so, I wish I understood her better. Could you I hear male voices better than female.
I can pass on the essence
explain to me what she said.
Yeah, the essence of it, Studs, was she said she was a 60s activist, that she's shell-shocked by what Carol calls the Philistine environment in the United States today, and particularly that people like herself, who she imagines as a person, she considers herself a person of ethics and intelligence and responsibility, are tarred as elitists.
Well, see, it was the 60s, and she's disappointed in that something that here we have this. I think losing hope, though, is the big thing. Something she did in the 60s still has an effect today. And I think, see, one of the big things is we think an individual, this comes back to us, that we think if we join a group, a community group, whether it be for lights or whether it be bigger issues like peace or civil rights or human rights or whether it be about environment, we think if a person joins a group, he loses or she loses individuality. It's precisely the opposite. In fact, Albert Einstein, who said it, and I'll paraphrase him very badly. See, I love to quote Albert Einstein. You know why?
Why?
No one dares contradict me.
Right, right.
And so Albert Einstein said, and I'll paraphrase this very badly, he says the individual becomes stronger as an individual. He feels he counts, and that's a key word in that book. I feel I count more than I did if I was on my own, saying, I don't need a union. I can defy General Motors, you know, the cowboy himself. Or I don't need to join this particular group. I might lose my individuality. Precisely the opposite is the case.
So, Studs Terkel, let me ask you then, for Carol, our caller from Erie and others, who may feel disillusioned, what's your advice to them? After talking with all of these people about hope, where do you advise Carol to find sources of hope today, right now?
Where do I find it?
Where should she?
So many groups. See, there. The only trouble is there are so many, and they're small in numbers. I think something happened in Seattle that was quite remarkable, and that's in a sense what Bob Kelly was talking about too. In Seattle, the blue collars, the Teamsters, and the students, for the moment, got together. And I think there can be these coalitions. What was needed, of course, is a big umbrella under which they can work. But there are hundreds of groups on issues that just spring out, whether it be environment of one way or another, whether it be whatever it might be, the right of people to express their opinion, whether it be human rights as well as civil rights. And there are so many groups. And when you join that group, something happens. By the way, I didn't have this in the book, but I work very improvisationally. I was a jazz disc jockey, among other things. I love jazz because it's improvisational. And I saw a piece in papers, and I forgot to put it in a book. It came out of Leeds, England. A psychiatrist or a guy who works in psychology made a discovery that people who take part in a community organization, no matter what it is, something happens to them biologically. They feel better. Like, I know this woman who's a writer, and she's, I'm sorry, I'm disillusioned. I don't want to be part of any such group. I don't want to be part of a peace group. I know they're good, but they mean nothing to me, and I'm disillusioned. And then she says, I have these headaches all the time. And that's when I said to her, that's why you have these headaches.
Don't be disillusioned.
This guy who was in Leeds doing the study hit something. Does something to the individual. Even biologically as well as psychically.
Studs Terkel, stand by. I want to turn to Jack for just a second. Jack, here is Studs Terkel at 91, full of this energy and enthusiasm and hope. It's not easy to hang on to that. What's the well that he's drawing from here?
Well, I think his experience and his sense of what's happened before. I mean, imagine what he's seen. In the 30s, working men and women could not legally organized for collective bargaining. Unions were all but illegal. And because people sat down at Ford and General Motors and other and U.S. Steel sat down, refused to work, they got the right to collective bargaining, and they got legislation that permanently changed, or at least changed for a long time, the balance of power in the society as between little people and the big powers. He saw a world of segregation, a world where the back of the bus, terrorism, lynching, segregation was the order of the day. He saw that break up under the greatest movement of social hope in this country's history, the civil rights movement. That broke up under the pressure of that movement. He saw a war in South Vietnam that was as tragically unnecessary as this war in Iraq, and he saw that war brought to an end by people all over the country who said no, 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 and again no. So he has seen the odds beaten again and again for decency.
Studs Terkel, Jack Beatty got your number there?
Not Jack Beatty.
Yes, it was.
Oh, Jack, you're lovely. You see, Jack hit it. And that's the matter of, I think we're suffering from a national Alzheimer's disease. There is no memory of yesterday in all these books I've worked on, I hope, recreates this memory. And he just did. It was during the New Deal, of course, the Wagner Act that people could organize. And it was the 60s, by the way, on that subject of the greatest generation, being that of World War II, is so much bourgeois, forgive me. Because there were many, there is no one greatest generation. The one of the 60s, the one that brought forth what Jack is talking about, as well as the feminist movement, as well as the movement against the virulent homophobia, as well as, of course, the rights of people of color. And this all came about. Even though it was a minority, I guess I love that phrase, the prophetic minority, is what Jack was talking about. And the book is dedicated to a certain couple I know, Clifford and Virginia Durr, two white people of Montgomery, Alabama. And they were remarkable, and I speak a good deal about them.
He was Rosa Parks' lawyer.
He was the FCC commissioner, in contrast to today, who wrote the blue book that said the air belongs to the people. But his wife, Virginia, was remarkably colorful. She had three ways to go. She could have been a Southern belle in the Gone with the Wind tradition and been sweet, quote-unquote, to a colored help and join a garden club. Or she could have been like her classmate, her schoolmate, who was conscience and brilliance and did nothing and went crazy, and that was Zelda Sarah Fitzgerald. Mrs. F. Scott Fitzgerald was her classmate, and who went crazy. She did, you know. But there's a third role, and that's the role she took to challenge this rotten system of segregation and poll tax and lynching, and she took that path. And they paid their dues, and they were smacked around and all that. And then 25 years later, 200,000 people take part in the Selma Montgomery March.
But in their house at 2 Felder Street, you say it was
the
place for
the very thing that those few people fought for. Mm-hmm. There were 200,000 people. And I was in their house that day they were celebrating with some of those original people. And one of them was saying, isn't it remarkable? Years ago, we knew one another by name, each of us, as we were egged and tomatoed and threatened. We knew each other by name. Today, I was on the street. I didn't know a single person there, and they didn't know me. It was wonderful. And that is almost a metaphor for the whole book.
Studs Terkel says, hang in there. His new book is Hope Dies Last. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in the voice, the hopes of Studs Terkel at 91? Is hope an old-fashioned sentiment or today's necessity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Studs Terkel about hope in a hard world. Studs Terkel joins us from Chicago. His new book is Hope Dies Last, Keeping the Faith in Difficult Times. You can join this conversation as well. Where does hope sit in your life today? And why do different people have such different relationships with hope? What do you hear in the voice, the hopes of the legendary Studs Terkel at 91? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Robert's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. First of all, it's a pleasure to hear Studs Terkel's voice after all these years.
Isn't it always a pleasure? Yeah.
And I didn't realize he was still alive, and I'm thrilled. I work as an interpreter now. I'm actually a sign language interpreter, and I work with theatrical interpreting a lot. But my first exposure to Studs Terkel's work was working. And the monologues that were produced and his writings about people's everyday lives were moving to me, and still after all these years, I mean, I read them 25 years ago, and they're still amazing to me. The fact that he was able to take what seemed to be drab, problematic existences and able to point out that people could live and still have hope.
Did you take hope from those interviews of Studs Terkel?
Oh, God, I did, yeah. I used to use them as monologues for auditions, and they actually work sometimes, but he actually, for me, the fact that he was able to say, let's take a snapshot of someone's life and see how important that can be, no matter if the person thinks it's important or not, I think that's incredibly hopeful.
Robert, and, we've got it. Thank you very much for your call. Studs Terkel, I want to ask you how hard you had to look to find a book full of hopeful people today. Was it easy? Was it hard?
I'm so moved by what I just heard.
Yeah.
That's what I was hoping would happen. You see, that he was affected and felt that. One quick story. Way back in one of the earliest books, interviewing this woman at a public housing project. She's very pretty and very poor. And I forgot if she was white or black. She was light-skinned, black perhaps. And she had three little kids. And they're jumping around, and she's never been talking into a tape recorder before in her life. And as the kids are jumping, they want to hear their mommy's voice. I say, "Now you be quiet, and I'm going to play it back." And she hears her voice for the first time in her life, and suddenly puts her hand to her mouth as she hears a voice. I says, "What's the matter?" She said, "I never knew I felt that way before." Well, boy, that was bingo. Bingo to me and bingo to her. You see, to her, it was something. So that's the way I think. That was fantastic. And to me, of course, I felt sensational. It's that kind of stuff that our friend was just talking about that I feel keeps me going.
Well, it keeps you going pretty well. We're just going to have to give Studs Terkel his head tonight. I want to hear from another of the people you spoke to for the book, Hope Dies Last. We spoke with him today. This is on tape, Studs, but it's Usama Alshaibi, a sound engineer at the Chicago Historical Society, an independent filmmaker. He recently became an American citizen at age 32. He moved from Iraq to the United States when he was in high school, and he told Studs Terkel about working in Iowa City when he was 18, just as the United States was entering the Gulf War.
It was a scary time. When people would ask me where I'm from, I would say Jordan, not Iraq. I would go out to bars and overhear people saying things about how we got to kill the sand niggers. People can't really look at me and tell where I'm from or who I am. It's kind of like I was a voyeur. I was part of this culture, but I was quiet because I was afraid. This was a very scary time. I had no visa. I had no status. I had to go to Omaha, Nebraska, hire a lawyer, and fight to be in this country. My father, who was working in the United Arab Emirates, was contacted by the Iraqi army. They wanted me for the draft, and this country wanted me out. I was 20 years old. I went in front of a judge and fought my case, stating that if I returned to my country, I would die. I got political asylum. Thank God. I will always be thankful for this country because they gave me political asylum to stay here.
Studs Terkel, there's your interview with a young Iraqi, now an American.
But I should point out that Usama is my sound engineer. Without him, I couldn't have done the book because I'm so inept mechanically. The voice you heard is that of Usama Alshaibi, my engineer.
That's right.
And by the way, Usama, tell why you missed. They had a 90th birthday party for me, and Garrison Keillor was there and Gary Wills. And Usama missed it. How come you missed my 90th birthday party? Tell why.
Studs Terkel, we don't actually have him. We only have him on tape. So he can't respond to you right now. You've got to tell us why he missed the party.
Usama? Oh, well, he missed it because he was being sworn in that day as a citizen. And he remembered the wonderful comments made by the judge who said to him, "Be proud of your legacy and heritage and speak out whenever you think something is wrong done by officials." I don't know who the judge was, but it was marvelous. So he missed my party because that day he became an American citizen. And so I'm so proud that to hear Usama's voice.
That's a pretty good excuse. Bob is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Hello, Bob. Are you there? Sounds like Bob's walked down the warehouse. Let's turn to Esther, calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Esther. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm here.
Hi, you're on the air.
I'd like to talk about my almost 95-year-old mother, who, although almost blind, is still knitting baby sweaters, which get sold through a friend's shop, and she makes $2,000 to $3,000 a year for the peace movement.
That's hopeful.
And how? Well, you see, we have all sorts of age, of course, is of no matter. The calendar ages, and it's just whatever. If you have a certain hope, there's a certain, strangely enough, vitality. I'm not now talking about miracle drugs or anything like that. I'm talking about the very fact that you feel something, that you're anti. What's the alternative to hope? Despair. As someone in the book said, Ted Shaw, I think it was. Someone says, if it's despair, that means head in the oven. Despair. So there is no alternative but hope. And I don't mean to be a Pollyanna. This is not a Pollyanna book, as readers can see. It is people with all sorts of doubts are there. But they have this will, and they have this belief. And despite the self-doubts, these people who we call activists, who join causes that seem so unfashionable and yet become the accepted order of the day.
You also talked, though, with Wallace Rasmussen, the former CEO of Beatrice Foods, $7, $8 billion company when he retired almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And he says, it sounded fairly bleak, at least in part. He said, a great country lasts about 400 years. We're in the declining morality period. That's what ruined Rome.
Well, you know, remember Wallace Rasmussen, whom I've known, has worked with his hands all his life and became a big shot. In fact, he became a ruthless big shot. He's proud of it. Forbes said one of the toughest CEOs there was. He built Beatrice Foods from a $3 billion thing to a $7 billion thing. But the one thing he never forgot is that he was a blue-collar working man himself. He could fix everything. He was not a bean counter. And he said, of course I work with unions. Of course I believe with them. And also I think I'd like to see the people who work there have cuts in it, not just Kenny Lay. And Enronism, by the way, he says, is not an exception. It's become part of the order of the day since we're teaching our students, he says, to make it no matter how. And he's quite condemnatory of what is happening.
But where is the hope in that, Studs?
A company from $3 to $7 billion is talking.
But where is the hope in that view, Studs Terkel?
Here's this guy himself. He has hope. He says he's teaching, as I was there that day when I saw him in Nashville, where he is now, there was this Aztec, a girl of Aztec ancestry, working there in his office, and she was learning all the facts. She says, in her, she's this Aztec girl is someone learning about, not about corporations as such, but about honesty in them, and about also understanding the role that working people play in making that company have a buck or two. So he has that kind of hope in his own in a remarkable way.
Yeah, I want to hear from one more of the people you interviewed for your book, Studs Terkel. In this case, Brigadier General Paul Tibbets. Paul Tibbets named the plane from which he dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima in 1945 after his mother, Enola Gay. He told Studs Terkel he had no regrets about dropping the bomb. Here, it's his lines are read here by WBUR's Fred Tice.
Second thoughts. No, Studs. Look. I got into the Air Corps to defend the United States to the best of my ability. On the way to the target, I was thinking, I can't think of any mistakes I've made. Maybe I did make a mistake. Maybe I was too damned assured. At 29 years of age, I was so shot in the ass with confidence, I didn't think there was anything I couldn't do. Of course, that applied to airplanes and people. So, no, I had no problem with it. I knew we did the right thing. I thought, yes, we're going to kill a lot of people. But by God, we're going to save a lot of lives. We won't have to invade Japan.
Studs Terkel, you are some kind of optimist that can find hope in the,
well,
in the testimony.
Well, again, you see, I happen to disagree with Colonel Tibbets, whom I admire, when he says it was that tough luck, referring, of course, to the Japanese people that Sunday morning. And he says he's doing his duty in that way. I happen to disagree. But I wanted his thoughts in it. Mm-hmm. He said he would have no compunction of doing it again. This, I must admit, does horrify me. So I'm saying that he is a very good man. He did his work as he felt was right. And the subject of whether or not we lose a million people has been subject to a great deal of discussion. We need to get into now. Because Stuart Udall wrote a book on this called Myths of August. And he questions whether or not it would have been necessary, because there were all sorts of negotiations going on. One was maintenance of the emperor, which did come through anyway. I don't want to go into that.
A big history.
But the big thing is, he felt he's doing his duty. I feel that duty is there too, but we are not the world. We are a powerful part of the world. And I believe strongly in the United Nations, of course, that I feel our president has shown such disdain for.
Let's get one more call. Bill's calling from Paxton, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello. The title of the book reminded me of my ABCs in Latin, which said, Dum spiro spero, which means, as long as I breathe, I hope. That brings me to the point that we all breathe and we live day to day. However, I find myself someday to be extremely hopeful, and events that happen worldwide, my personal life, the community life, makes me go through the ups and downs, ups and downs.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your guest has to say about the overall view of this. Thank you.
Got it. Thanks, Bill. Studs, can you speak to Bill?
Yeah, Jack Beatty?
No, this was a caller, Bill, saying...
Oh, that was Bill.
He wants to believe in hope, but he's got some down days.
Well, of course. Oh, by the way, of course you do. I don't mean for this book to be a panacea. It's not something you take and you feel better as a result. It's not that. Of course the doubts are there. But the fact that something can be, there's something Kathy Kelly, can't leave her out. She's at the end of the book. Kathy Kelly was nominated, by the way, for the Nobel Peace Prize several times. And a wonderful Iranian woman won it this year. And Kathy is the one who said, she was a disciple of Dorothy Day, who founded the Catholic Worker. And she said, in answer to questions, why are you getting arrested all the time for civil disobedience, for peace thing? She says, I'm working toward a world in which it would be easier for people to behave decently. And that very phrase is so simple and so true. A world in which it would be easier for people to behave decently. And that's what it's really all about, I think.
Studs, we've just got another minute. What did you find? Did you find enough hope to keep it all rolling out there?
I think there's a tremendous amount of hope there. At the same time, there's a great deal of doubt. We know the media is controlled more and more by fewer and fewer. An Australian Neanderthal named Rupert Murdoch is one of the strongest media moguls in the country. That in itself is subject to humor, of course, a grim sort of humor, a W.C. Fields kind of humor. I think W.C. Fields is the one who probably wrote the scenario for this administration. Because he was kind of the master of outrageous humor, except that it ain't funny, McGee. But I do think there's throughout the sense of hope is there. And I think as long as we breathe, as the caller said, it's there.
Studs Terkel at 91, keeping hope alive, as they say in Chicago. Studs Terkel, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. It's been a wonderful hour.
Studs Terkel's new book is Hope Dies Last, Keeping the Faith in Difficult Times. Jack Beatty, there's a fire blazing from another time and right now, too.
Yes, and two of his subjects refer to Emily Dickinson's poem. It goes, hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could have bashed the little bird that kept so many warm.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us. And here with that little bird with feathers, here's to hope. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.